Welcome to Queer Music Heritage and part two of my interview with John Bacchino. I'm J.D. Doyle, and the opening song was one John wrote with Holly Near called Bird Gonna Fly. It appeared on her 1987 album, Don't Hold Back. And we didn't have time in part one to get to sort of a surprise I had for John regarding Holly.
I contacted her and asked if she would contribute a couple questions for this interview.
Oh my goodness. Wow. That's one of the surprises you were talking about, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
She suggested, what is the difference between being a pianist and being an accompanist?
Oh, that's a really good question. That is a really, really good question. To a certain degree, you've got to have your craft down, of course. You know, you've got to be capable and have a breadth of knowledge of musical styles, depending upon who you're working with, of course. But being a good accompanist is providing a support system for the singer that you're working with. And I always feel like there's a sixth sense about it when one is a good accompanist and when the singer and the accompanist are really in tune. And I always think of when you see a flock of birds and they're flying and then they all of a sudden all turn at the same time and you think, how did they know? How did they do that? That kind of connectedness is how I see, you know, a good accompanist with the singer that they're supporting. And the trick is, too, to be, it's not about you, you know, as the accompanist. It's about, in a way, it's like when people play my songs, when I see a singer singing my songs, and I've been doing a lot of master classes in colleges with students singing my songs, and the highest compliment that I can give their accompanist is, I didn't notice you. You know what I mean? Because it means that the accompanist is not doing anything to draw attention to themselves, that they're just being supportive of a singer. So.
Well, she kind of went on in that same vein, and she wrote, something very special happens between a singer and a pianist after working together for over 20 years.
Right.
Can that craft, that intuitive understanding, be taught? Or does it come with time?
Golly. Well, I don't think with us it came with time. I think that, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if she mentioned this, but the first time we rehearsed, she was getting ready to do, she and Ronnie were doing a 6-week tour. I had done a solo concert with Ronnie first, and then I had to, you know, learn all of their individual and duo material for this 6-week tour. And so Holly was living in, San Francisco area. And I flew up there, and we had scheduled like 4 hours or something for rehearsal. And I think we rehearsed for an hour, and that we were done. You know, it was just easy. It's about listening, I think, a lot, too, on the part of both the singer and the accompanist, and tuning in. And I don't know that it does take a long time to achieve that if the accompanist and the singer are musically compatible and if the accompanist is listening. You know, like I said, I think we had it from the very beginning.
Taking a break from the music, tell me about your involvement with the 1989 TV movie My Boyfriend's Bad.
Oh my God. That's amazing. Well, Holly was friends with a TV actor named Jill Eikenberry. And she and her husband were in a TV show called L.A. Law. And Jill had gotten this TV movie called My Boyfriend's Back that she was going to be in with Sandy Duncan and Judith Light. And she asked Holly if Holly knew anyone that she could work with because the three of them were going to be doing their own singing. They played a girl group from the 60s that was reuniting, and they needed to do their own singing. And Jill really needed somebody to coach her and help her with her singing. So Holly recommended me, and so I went over and, you know, met with Jill. And then Jill told Judith Light about me, and I went over and worked with Judith as well. And, you know, we worked together. I helped coach them. And they wanted me there on the set and said, well, gee, there's a small part in the movie for our accompanist, and maybe we can get you that part. So I ended up having a part in the movie as well as their accompanist, just so they could have me around. It was my one professional acting experience. It was really fun.
In 1990, your second release was called Solitude Lessons.
Right.
And more of your well-known songs are starting to get out there. In particular, could you tell me about Until a Balance Tips?
Sure. Gosh, I don't remember writing. As it is with most of the songs, I kind of don't remember writing them. They just kind of happen through me, and then they're done, and it's sort of a miracle. So I don't remember what I was experiencing when that song happened. I have a feeling that it was the political awareness that was sort of growing in me as a result of working with Holly. Most of the songs I wrote before that were really personal and love, mostly love songs, mostly unrequited love songs. And I sort of call them my I Want You and You Don't Want Me and I'm Really Miserable songs. I think Until the Balance Tips was an attempt at writing something a little more conscious of the world.
Until the Balance Tips also was used on an AIDS benefit CD, Feeding the Flame.
It was indeed. People really like that song.
There's a full moon rising tonight. They say there will be an eclipse. Watch it, nationwide. The sun, the earth, and the moon side by side by side. And the moon goes black until the balance tips. There's a country on fire tonight. Some say we must tighten our grip. Shake them, save them, turn the tide. The eagle, the bear, and the dove side by side by side. But the dove can't fly until the balance tips. They wait in shadow. They live what they know with a prayer on their lips until the balance tips. The pain they pull through, the good they can do is a prayer on their lips until the balance tips. There are thousands dying. Some say they chose their own scripts. Blame them, shame them, drugs denied. The sickness, the hate, and the hope side by side by side. With the hope unfed until the balance tips. Our eyes on the future and let the past be past. All good things will come in their own time, in their own way. We can dance together in the light of a brighter day. There's a
I think that's a wonderful song. John doing his own composition, Until the Balance Tips.
Tell me about working with Romanowski and Phillips.
Ah, I love those guys. We had so much fun. Brilliant, wonderful musicians, dear friends. Politically, again, I think with Holly, I think I experienced a level of political awareness, but it largely had to do with peace, politics, you know, world politics and things like that, and some, you know, gay and lesbian issues. But with Romanowski and Phillips, they were all about gay rights, but with such a great sense of humor. I would encourage your listeners who may not be familiar with their work to go out and find some, because
if they're my listeners, they are familiar.
They are. Oh, good. Thank you for promoting them, because they're just brilliant. They are still, and they were then, just doing extraordinary work.
Well, you produced their album, Be Political, Be Polite.
Yes, I did. I did. And tricky. There are delicate personal politics involved, especially when people have strong opinions. And when it's your own music, you always have strong opinions. So it was a complicated process. We got through it well, I think, and remained really dear friends. But it was tricky, you know, as it always is. It was a wonderful, enjoyable, hysterical, because we laughed a lot, complicated process.
You and Ron wrote a song together, A Measure of Sadness.
Yes, we did. We did. That's a sweet little song. I haven't thought about that for a long time. I think that, as with most of those rare times when I've co-written, most of the time it's been, I'm given a lyric. You know, and I think that was the case here where Ron had a lyric.
Well, Ron has told me that you both had short-lived crushes on each other.
Oh, we did.
And you each wrote a song for each other.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what song.
His was He Wasn't Talking to Me.
Oh, right. Well, see, the tricky part about that was that I was in a relationship, you know, and I think that's probably what his song has to do with. God, I'm trying to remember what song I wrote for
him. It's called Air.
Oh, of course it was. Wow. You know more about me than I do. I think I just need to call you up and ask you things from time to time about my own life. Wow. Oh, it's a very sexy song, this Air. I wish I had a copy of it I could send to you, because it's pretty hot. Wow. Yeah, it's all about, you know, unrequited lust.
Well, I don't have that song to play for you, but I do have the song John and Ron wrote together called A Measure of Sadness. It's from Ron's 1992 solo album, Hopeful Romantic.
If Gershwin were writing this tune, he'd sit at the piano and croon love songs unbroken in rhymes yet unspoken of starry-eyed lovers with hearts full of moon. But I'm the one writing this song with a resume not quite as long. I stop and I stutter, I spout and I sputter, knowing my track record's not quite so strong. You can't write a love song when you're not in love. There's no heart, there's no soul, there's no love to the sound. And anyone will tell you that to do it well, your heart must be broken and battered around. So don't despair if you're just not inspired. If your voice or your pen are too tired, so prolific, there's also a measure of sadness required. You can't write a love song when you're not in love. There's no heart, there's no soul, there's no love to the sound. And anyone will tell you that to do it well, battered around. So if you don't feel a tune coming on, and your heart's beating healthy and strong, it could mean no one's used it, or broken or bruised it. It could mean there's not enough wrong. You won't wax poetic if you're apathetic. There's also a measure of sadness required.
I want to slip in another lesser-known John Bacchino song. Australian artist David Campbell sang it on his 1997 album, Taking the Wheel. Besides the title track and the song Grateful, the album also included the very nice song Gentle Souls and Tender-Hearted Fools.
Do you weep at the end of an ocean sunset? Do you run in the rain while the cold wind blows? Have your friends all agreed you're a hopeless dreamer, melting at the gift of a single rose? Have you looked in the eyes of a perfect stranger, sworn it was love at first sight, then wiped away the tears as you watched them walking into the bitter night? Maybe there's a place we can go, a place where feelings freely flow, where everybody falls in love far too easily. No one tries to play it cool, just gentle souls and tender-hearted fools. Do you wake with your eyes full of hope and wonder? Do you feel like your spirit does not grow old? Though your heart has been broken and left in pieces, do you still search for someone to hold? Is it easy to see just how much I love you? Is it true we are two of a kind? Would you follow me off to some quiet corner with fragile hearts entwined? Maybe there's a place we can go, a place where feelings freely flow, where everybody falls far too easily. No one tries to play it cool, just gentle souls and tender-hearted fools. Sentimental me, sweet romantic you, out of touch. Do we really feel the same, or do I just care too? Where feelings freely flow, where everybody falls in love far too easily. No one tries to play it cool, just gentle souls and tender-hearted fools. Gentle souls and
David Campbell. For some of my listeners, I need to preface the next question I asked John, and it's about Stephen Swartz. Stephen is famous for the Broadway hits Pippin, Godspell, and Wicked, to name just a few. Movies such as Prince of Egypt, and has won several Grammy and Academy Awards.
Holly Near was a very pivotal person in your career, and according to my research, around 1989 you met another pivotal person, Stephen Swartz. Tell me what influence he had on the direction of your writing.
Ah, okay. I met Stephen because he happened to accompany Ronnie Gilbert in a benefit, and she wanted him to play in a restaurant by the sea my song, to accompany her on that song. And he had to learn it from a recording. And he really liked it, and he asked her, you know, who wrote this song, and do you have any more of his stuff? And, of course, she did, and she had a cassette of a bunch of songs of mine, and she gave it to Stephen, and I got a phone call from this famous, fancy New York theater writer guy. And he called up and said he was going to be in L.A., and could we get together? And I didn't know much about him, but I knew he was famous. And I always had this sort of drive to share my work with anybody that might be helpful. So we got together, and he was staying at Dean Pitchford's house. Dean Pitchford, who wrote Footloose, the songs for Footloose and such. And we sat at Dean's grand piano, and Stephen played me some songs, and I thought, he's very good, Stephen Schwartz. And we became best friends. And the influence, I would say, when we met, Stephen had only written songs for a concept, for a context, for a theater piece mostly. And he had not written songs just because he felt something, which I found really unusual. I was at the opposite end of the spectrum. I had only written songs out of personal experience, and not for any particular context. So the thing, I'd say the greatest influence is that from the moment we met, he started encouraging me to write for theater. And I started encouraging him to just write because he felt things. And he now has two CDs of songs that he wrote just because he felt things, and I've written a Broadway show. So I think we've influenced each other in innumerable ways.
I understand you had an indirect role in the creation of the musical Wicked.
I did, as a matter of fact, and I'm quite proud of that, and quite happy that it turned out certainly the way it did, my goodness. And that is that Holly and I were doing it was pretty much the best gig that I ever had, that Holly and I ever had, which was a wealthy lesbian was having a lesbian music conference, music festival on Maui. I mean, how good is that? And then she invited us to come, paid us handsomely, as I recall, and put us up in a great hotel on the beach in Maui for five or six days. And we had one performance, like the cushiest job ever. So Stephen at the time was in Los Angeles working on, I believe it was Prince of Egypt, the movie, you know, for which he wrote the song. And I called him up and said, okay, I'm going to Maui. I've got to have a great hotel room. I already called. They can give me a room with two big beds in it. And it's right on the beach. You know, fly over. I said, it's going to be me and 300 lesbians. Please come and keep me company. And so he was like, yeah, absolutely. He did, in fact, fly over. And Holly and her then partner and Stephen and I, on one of our days off, went on a snorkeling trip. And we were on the boat going out to the snorkeling spot. And Holly said, I just finished the most interesting book called Wicked. And she told us the story, and Stephen told me afterward that as soon as he heard the premise of the story, he thought it was the best idea for a musical that he'd ever heard in his life. And when we got back to land, before he even read the book, he called his lawyer and said, find out who's got the rights to this. So all I'm saying is, if I hadn't invited him to come to Maui, there might not be a Wicked.
It was an easy answer when I asked if the song The Artist at 40 was autobiographical.
Completely. Well, they're all autobiographical. Every single song all of the issues and the midlife stuff that comes up for somebody when, you know, when they turn 40. A lot of it for me as a writer, was crammed into that song, definitely.
To be too little, I'm afraid to be too much. I'm afraid that I might shatter at the slightest touch. I'm afraid of growing older. I'm afraid someday I'll see a desiccated shell that doesn't feel at all like me. Creating, creating, and talk about creating. I'm so busy making art that there's no time to live the life the art is imitating. Too frozen, too fluid, too rigid. I'm afraid to throw the lights on, I'm afraid to brave the dark. I'm afraid of growing older, growing colder, losing some essential spark. Having birthdays with more candles, shedding more light on the fact that I'm no wiser than I was. And there's no way of turning back.
Creating, creating, and talk about creating. I'm so busy making art that there's no time to live the life the art is imitating.
For the momentary sweetness. I'm afraid of growing older. Well, maybe growing older would be fine. But shrinking older, now that's a major fear of mine. Sinking to mere thinking from a laughing gas ceiling of unfettered feelings. Falling with a thud to the floor in a single tiny bedroom of the mansion where I lived and loved before. A single tiny bedroom with a barricaded door. I'm afraid to love too little, I'm afraid to love too much. I'm afraid that I might shudder, melt like butter at the lightest touch. I'm afraid of pulling back, I'm afraid of falling in. Oh, such warm and intoxicating skin. A sinful opportunity to steep in. Arms to sleep in, lips to keep in, biting me back for just the other side of this damn barricaded door.
Creating, creating.
I'm afraid of being whole, I'm afraid to fall apart. I'm afraid to take another step with such a heavy heart. I'm afraid to be myself, I'm afraid it's not enough. I'm afraid to keep complaining, but it's not within my training to be tight-lipped and tough.
Creating, creating, and talk about creating. I'm so busy making art that there's no time to live the life the art is imitating.
I'm afraid that I'm not learning what it takes to make light shine. But the pages I see shining as they're turning somehow aren't really mine.
There's a secret in here somewhere, or a pattern or a clue. I'm afraid I can't decide if it's a shining universal answer or a tarnished point of view.
Another demo is by Lois Sage, and you already mentioned that she was the first person to perform your work in New York.
Right, she was.
And the demo I'm thinking of is called A Friend to the Mall, and one of your most lyrically gay songs that I've heard.
It is. Well, and that song, of course, comes from a real experience. When I was playing in a gay piano bar in Santa Monica called the Bar Sinister, which always cracked me up, on Main Street. But anyway, I played in this piano bar, and there was a woman who came in almost every night, and she was a nurse, and she drank a lot. And I just kind of wove the song around her. And it's basically about a woman who hangs out in a gay bar and, you know, lusts after the men that she can never have. And I think it is also part of my story in that I always seem to lust for people that I can't have. That seems to be a pattern with me as well.
Yes, she's a friend to them all, and a lover to none. She's just one of the guys till they holler last call. Then the fantasy dies, and she's only a friend to them all. She smiles at the back of the bar with a drink in her hand and a hand on his knee. But he's clutching the arm of another man, sitting where she longs to be. She tosses a come hither wink with a sigh in her eye and an eye on his friend. He makes love to her dancing, but she knows she'll head home alone in the end. And yes, she's a friend to them all, and a lover to none. She's just one of the guys till they are the last call. Then the fantasy dies, and she's only a friend to them all. She swears at the man in the jar with the bead in her head and her head to the wall. Then pointlessly checking the mirror, she sets herself up for the fall. Home with a joint after hours, she's had too much to think, still she thinks of her men. Then she breaks down and laughs at her rotten luck, knowing she's lost them again to each other. But yes, she's a friend to them all, and a lover to none. She's just one of the guys till they have her last call.
I think Not a Cloud in the Sky is such a moving song, and one that I could personally relate to since I've lost my partner recently.
Yeah,
could you talk about that song?
Sure. It was written for, actually, the first musical that I wrote, which was called Urban Myths. It doesn't exist really anymore. But it was a series of seven short urban legends, basically, that a playwright friend, James Wedekind, and I turned into seven short musical pieces that formed, you know, a show. And the last piece, the seventh one, was an AIDS myth that we made up. It was an urban myth that we would like to see, and it's the story, basically, of a miraculous healing is what happens at the end of it. And the song Grateful was used in that as well. A man who's dying, who's actually just about preparing to have it's called Last Supper. He's has his lover make a big dinner, and he's preparing to kill himself because he's dying rapidly anyway and is in so much pain that he's just going to take a bunch of pills and end it. But Not a Cloud in the Sky happens at the very beginning of that piece, of that little urban myth. And it is, in fact, his partner, alone on stage, ironing very meticulously and, singing basically through clenched teeth because he's not allowed himself to experience the grief of his partner's illness and impending death. So he just holds everything in. It's interesting, in writing that song, sometimes, and I love when this happens, I don't know where the songs are going to go. And I wrote it as my brother was dying, so there's a parallel there. But actually, I started to write it for a much more mundane reason. I had just been out somewhere, and there was this fellow to whom I was very attracted, who basically snubbed me in a kind of harsh way, which really hurt my feelings. And I found myself coming home and literally scrubbing the grout in the bathroom tile. And basically it was, you know, exerting control, because I certainly had no control over making him like me. And so I found myself, you know, doing things that I could control and being meticulous. And then I started writing about myself being meticulous and anal retentive and whatever, and thought that it was going to be about that. But then it started to veer in a very different direction and be about someone who's meticulous and controlling the situation because their partner's dying and they can't control that. That's how that song happened.
I know. I'll alphabetize CDs, scrub the grout in the bathroom tile. Anything to take some control, make order out of chaos for a tiny little while. I'll smile a satisfied smile, Lord of all I survey. Not a speck of dust, not a painting off plum, not a cloud in the sky today. Tight rein on that tongue, boy, white knuckle grip on the slip of a thought. Everything is perfectly fine, finally perfect, blinding white sheets with hospital corners immovably taut, and peace of mind that I've bought in my usual way. Not a speck of doubt, not a smile off plum, not a cloud in the sky today. There's a dam that I saw in a movie once, and the dam had a tiny little crack. The crack became a bigger crack till the dam couldn't hold the water back. When the flooding stopped, not a soul in the fairy tale village below had been spared. Well, I've got plenty of spackle, no damn crack will catch me unprepared. No, sir, I'm not scared. Just iron that wrinkled tie, smooth out that furrowed brow. Something's awry outside, but there's no need to pry into that right now. I simply won't allow any fear or dismay. Believe it doesn't hurt, believe it helps to pray. Believe I just don't care, believe it's actually a blessing to be this self-aware. Believe hope's not a lie, and things that need to be have been addressed. Believe there is no true goodbye, and since this shirt is so impeccably pressed, you're not really about to die. Okay, look, if I don't deny, I'll cry and cry and cry and cry till all the walls are washed away. No, I could not tolerate such disarray. So, not a crack in this dam, not a tear in this eye. Not a single fucking cloud in the sky today.
That comes from the Grateful compilation and was sung by John.
Also in 2000, you joined the movie music world. Tell me about your involvement with Joseph, King of Dreams.
Well, it's funny because Stephen Schwartz had written The Prince of Egypt for DreamWorks, and he would tell me stories about working with, you know, sort of interfacing with a corporate entity. And I just thought, oh my, and, you know, having meetings with Jeffrey Katzenberg, and it all sounded absolutely terrifying to me. I couldn't imagine doing something like that. And then by a bizarre series of coincidences, a friend of mine knew a producer at DreamWorks and asked me if she could give her some samples of my work because they were looking for somebody to write for this movie, and I never expected to get it, and I did. And there I was in the same situation that I thought would be so terrifying when Stephen told me about his experiences. And it was really hard and really scary. And I think that seems to be a recurring lesson for me. Perhaps the lesson is to realize that I don't like collaboration. I'm not sure which. But it was a hard thing to do, to have somebody tell me what to write, to have assignments, and then to have meetings and dissect it and talk about every syllable and every note, tear it apart. Because that's the exact opposite of what the creative process normally is for me, which is, fluid and intuitive and almost like a dream state, and it's the opposite of overanalyzed. It's accepted. I just let it come through and I don't question it. And it's a miracle and I don't want to mess with it. And yet, in the context of writing for something, whether it's a movie or a theater piece, you scrutinize. So it was a lesson.
It turned out pretty well.
It turned out, I'm very proud of it. It turned out really well. There was one moment that was really interesting. There's a song called Better Than I, which is sort of the big song from the movie, and it actually won the Video Premiere Award for the Song of the Year, because they had thought about possibly releasing it as a theatrical release film because it was turning out so well, but at that point the animation wasn't quite up to the standard that it would have needed to be, so they couldn't do that. So it just went direct to video. The writers had asked me to write this, they said, we've got like 4 pages of dialogue and information. Can you turn it all into a song? And so I did. It had a lot of stuff in it, so it needed to be, couldn't be concise. And I played it. I sent them a little recording of it, and they loved it, and everybody was liking it. And I went out there for a week, and at the end of the week, I had to play it live for Jeffrey Katzenberg. Always daunting. And I went out there, and they pumped me up all week. We were having meetings about other songs and stuff. And they're like, oh, Jeffrey's going to love this. It's fabulous. It's fabulous. So got to Friday, and I had to play it for Jeffrey. He hated it. He absolutely hated it and just, ripped me to shreds, basically, and said, we need an anthem. We need something that's going to soar. We need something that's going to break our hearts. And I left the meeting thinking, ah, damn, Jeffrey Katzenberg, what does he know? This was really good, and he's an idiot, and that's, blah, blah, blah. And I'm going to quit. I can't do this. And I flew home and was sort of gnashing my teeth the whole time thinking, And eventually, I was really in a state of despair. And interestingly, the state that I was in was the same state that the character was in at the moment of this song. And so I wrote a song that expressed, certainly the getting into the song, expressed the despair that I was feeling. And it's a song called Better Than I, which starts out, I thought I did what's right. I thought I knew the answers. I thought I, chose the surest road, but that road brought me here. Well, yes, that's where Joseph is, but it's exactly where I was with regard to writing the song. So it was one of those things where my own life and the character's experience completely intersected and gave birth to one of my favorite songs that I've ever written. So that Jeffrey Katzenberg is a smart fella.
I thought I did what's right. I thought I had the answers. I thought I chose the surest road, but that road brought me here. So I put up a fight and told you how to help me. Now just when I have given up, the truth is coming clear. You know better than I. You know the way. side, for you know better than I. If this has been a test, I cannot see the reason, but maybe knowing I don't know is part of getting through. I try to do what's best, and faith has made it easy to see the best thing I can do is put my trust in you. For you know better than I. You know the way I've let go. The need to know why. For you know better than I. So
That was Better Than I by David Campbell, and he does a version of it on the Grateful compilation, but we just heard the bigger, full orchestra version from the movie.
One more song from the Grateful compilation, and it may set a record for being the song most about longing. Tell me about the song Unexpressed.
Well, it is, in fact, my favorite song that I've ever written, and it didn't start out to be that way. I wrote it and went, nah, and put it away. And forgot about it for maybe a year or so. And in 92, when I was packing to leave Santa Monica and move to New York, I was putting my lyric books in a box. I remember exactly where I was sitting on the floor by my piano, putting lyric books in a box and sort of thumbing through them. And I came across Unexpressed and thought, gee, how did this go again? And went to the piano and played through it and thought, God, that's not bad. Why did I put that one away? Oh, gee, I kind of like it. And then over the next, you know, few months or whatever, I was kind of found myself playing it over and over and over again and kind of falling in love with it. And I have no idea how it got written. I don't know. I don't remember what was going on in my life, you know, but where it came from.
Sometimes I think my heart will burst like a balloon inside my chest with all the love that's waiting here unexpressed. Fingers that ache to intertwine, warmest of chords but missing tune. Where is the laugh to echo mine? Send it soon. The words my lips would form, the circle these two arms would make safe and warm. Someone could be safe and warm. Maybe the love we yearn to give can find find a release some other way. Coloring how we choose to live every day. The kindness we can share. The kindness we can share. The comfort these two arms might lend in despair. Someone's always in despair. Still, I'm longing to meet that pair of eyes. Dark as the night or endless blue. Holding a light, I'll recognize something clear, something true, something that seems to mean something I haven't seen since you.
Unexpressed has sung by Broadway actor Gavin Creel, who was also in the cast of It's Only Life.
In late 2000, you were involved in a project led by the legendary Hal Prince. Tell us about Three.
Three, well, another one of those big, surprising theater experiences. I became friends when I moved to New York with Hal's daughter, Daisy Prince, who's also a wonderful director. And she was in the circle, she was friends with the circle of friends that I had in New York, and so we met soon after I moved here. And then through her, of course, I got to know her, her dad and her mom, both of whom I adore, and, both of whom really, really respect what I do and are very, very supportive. And, so Hal was, putting together an evening of three short musicals, and asked if I had anything to contribute. So we took one of the pieces from Urban Myths, one of those little urban legends, called Lavender Girl, and we expanded it, and, Scott Schwartz, Stephen Schwartz's son, directed it beautifully, and we put them, when we added that, and that is the middle piece of this show, which eventually became a show called Three. Which is the number three, and then H-R-E-E, spelled kind of weirdly. And we did a recording of it. We did it in Philadelphia at the Prince Theater, interestingly. But it was a great experience, you know. I mean, and Hal, while he didn't direct our piece, he directed the last third, you know, he oversaw the whole thing, and I got to see, you know, I knew him as a friend, but I got to see him, you know, in action a little bit, which was fascinating. A brilliant fellow who has more Tonys than anybody else alive. I think he's got 20 or 21.
And here's a song from this show, Three, from the segment Lavender Girl, written by John. It's the song Dancing, sung here by Patti LuPone.
Who could believe I'd feel all of the things I'm feeling? This emotional glow, I've imagined it, though I couldn't place the time or face. Now yours is the face I see, shining in expectation of more parties, more lights, and a thousand more nights of dancing. Time, now that I have these memories, and I'll always and laughing there, who could not feel the joy? Waltzing in every moment, every color and sound on this merry-go-round, I never knew I'd felt so few till I let myself chance this evening of dancing.
This is J.D. Doyle with Queer Music Heritage, and I'm going to close part two with one of my very favorites. But I hope you come back for the last part of my three-hour special on the music of John Bacchino. Another very popular song is If I Ever Say I'm Over You. I think it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, and that was the end of course, as always, it seemed, the end of a relationship. I'm over him.
Well, I've thought if there's ever one of your songs that I would love to hear done by Barbra Streisand, that's the song.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've been trying to get to Babs for years. That would be remarkable. That's hers, of course, is the voice that every singer, every writer dreams of hearing sing their songs.
Well, we don't have a version by Streisand, at least not yet. But one of the first people to record the song is a favorite artist of mine, Suede, from her 1992 album, Barely Blue.
If I ever say I'm over you, the unsentimental things I do will have driven out the ghosts somehow. If I tend to disregard your touch, well, it seems to me it would be such a waste of time to let this poor heart feel. But sometimes a photograph can make me cry or force a laugh, and somehow the memory of how complete we used to be keeping me from you. If you ever hear me doubt the past, it's a simple fact. We didn't last. We're on the ground. I'm not sure if we can.